Welcome to The Sound of Economics. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel, and The Sound of Economics is Bruegel's podcast. Today we have a special edition in which we talk about the US election and the implications this election will have for economic policies in the United States, but of course for also economic policies in Europe and the transatlantic relations. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by two Bruegel scholars who are both American, but both live in Europe, both have deep expertise on the United States and on, of course, its politics and its economic policies. First of all, Rebecca Christie is with us, and she has been covering previous US elections and is really an expert on finance. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And let me also welcome Scott Marcos, who is also an expert on digital and tech and the single market and many other aspects, but also has covered privacy aspects in the United States. Scott, welcome.
Thank you very much, Guntram. Again, happy to be here.
Let's talk about this topic first in very broad terms. I mean, we have an election in less than a week coming up. That election probably won't be decided immediately. It could take quite some time. And the new president, as he comes in or stays, will have a big job because the country looks pretty divided. And it looks very, very, very ugly. And the situation looks very confrontational also. So perhaps, Rebecca, let me turn first to you. Can you give us a sense where you see the US after this election? What are the key issues? Will a new president even have the time to worry about economic issues? Or what will be going on? What will be the main priorities, the way you see it playing out in the coming weeks?
Presidential transitions are always a big time in Washington, even when it's a re-election, let alone when there's a change of party, and especially now when we've had one of the more divisive political cycles in recent memory. Presuming that Joe Biden is able to win the presidency from Donald Trump, he will face an uphill battle to get the Congress on board and look at how to get America back in the game. Trump has spent 4 years cutting the US out of so many multilateral institutions, so many deals on climate and trade. And Biden will have to prioritize which ones are most important for the economic security of the country and which ones are most likely to have popular support.
Thanks, Rebecca. And just to push you a bit further on this point, what do you think should a Biden president, or what do you think should a Trump president actually focus on?
If Trump is reelected, I think we can continue to see isolationism. I think American companies will really struggle to find the quality of workforce they want because they won't be able to hire globally the way they're used to. And I think the technology companies will face a lot of regulation. Looking at more government intervention from any political administration that emerges. But if Trump wins again, they're going to be looking at things that are probably directed, extremely political, possibly retaliatory, depending on how Trump feels when he gets up in the morning and how much support he has from the Senate. Under a Biden administration, you're likely to see at least a verbal commitment to rejoining the Paris Accords, the climate deal, although following that up with policy is going to be difficult. You're going to see really an internal debate about how to jumpstart immigration and jumpstart global hiring, because that's something that has always been a little contentious. And because of the way that normal routines have been interrupted by this presidency, it's not going to be so straightforward to just go back to how things were. Enfranchisement is really a big deal. This election is going to be decided as much by who can get to the polls as how they vote. We're seeing that in the court decisions, the voter ID discussions, talks about signature matching and absentee ballots. So on the other side of this election, you're going to see a lot of people saying, how do we make sure that we count? And when I say a lot of people, I mean specifically people that America has worked hard to disenfranchise in the past. Minority populations, particularly Black and Indigenous peoples, also women more broadly. These are easy to just put aside as cultural issues, but they really have a lot to deal with the economy, particularly now where these are the populations who are performing a lot of the essential work in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic, which we haven't even talked about. If the American medical situation continues to deteriorate, the economy is going to be frozen. And it's really going to be a question for either Trump or Biden to keep global investors pouring money into the US so they can keep the lights on and the doors open.
Yes, indeed. The COVID situation is, of course, dramatic. The numbers are rising. And one of the big, big challenges will be to control the pandemic and make sure that the economic fallout can be contained. Scott, perhaps over to you. Where do you see the U.S. After this election?
Well, I see the U.S. divided. The U.S. has been divided. It'll continue to be divided. We've seen something like 40% of the American public supporting Trump no matter what. Those numbers have been remarkably stable over the past 4 years. We have seen some shifts, though. Importantly, we see that Trump has lost support long-term among white suburban voters. This is a trend of possibly historic significance because it basically means the Republican Party has now fastened on a shrinking demographic, white, non-college educated, mostly male voters. So it'll have some implications long-term. Coming back to respond to one point that Rebecca made, I'm a bit less concerned about voter suppression than I was before for the simple reason that 62 million Americans have already voted. Assuming that there isn't too much fraud in counting the votes, then they can't be kept from the polls because they've already been there. But historically, voter suppression has been a huge problem and I think continues to need attention. As far as where things go, which I think is really more where your question was, a Biden administration is going to have to face multiple challenges all at the same time. First and foremost, Biden administration is going to need to deal with a pandemic that's completely out of control, and for which I would say he rightly says the Trump administration has never had a plan. They treated it as a political problem, not as a health problem. So that's going to need instant attention. You've got lots of Americans out of work. You have a CARES Act that expired, and there was no political agreement to extend it. So you've got businesses closing, and during the winter, this is likely to intensify. Remember, the United States is going into, well, either you would say it's a third wave of the pandemic, or what Dr. Fauci would claim is that the U.S. never really came out of the first. But at this point, they're seeing something like 80,000 new cases per day and growing. I would say that there are going to be huge impacts. Now, the economy is the second major area after the pandemic, because the pandemic has been an economic crisis as well as a health crisis, also a geopolitical crisis. And on the economy, the stock market in the United States continues to defy gravity most of the time. Occasionally, it'll have a bad day, but it seems to be up even at times when unemployment is high and when most other indicators say that it shouldn't be. So clearly, measures are going to be needed. But the geopolitical issues, I think, are also important. The damage that a Trump administration has done to U.S. alliances, partnerships that have existed for 70 years, amazing stability, are really largely in the garbage can today, not to say the toilet. And if anything blows up, we can no longer rely on our historic friends to work with us because they don't know what we're going to do. And for that matter, getting new agreements will be difficult, because nobody will trust any agreement with the United States to last more than 4 or at best 8 years.
So let's talk about the geopolitics and the global agreement in a minute. But let me bring back Rebecca on some more strongly economic issues. But I think you made an important point and contradicted Rebecca on the voter suppression. And I do want to push Rebecca and you a bit on this issue and relate it also to the fact that in this pandemic, minorities have been hugely disadvantaged. I mean, we know that the number of cases among Black Americans has been so much higher, the number of COVID cases, than among white educated. And we know that many people do not have proper access to health insurance, and those people are often, again, the minorities. So we have actually here a huge issue, it seems to me. The division of the country is also a division across racial divisions that are really, really important. And I would say the U.S. president, can he be called a racist?
I am sad to say that he can, and he's been quite explicit about it. It's one of the real tragedies of this administration is how things that were, if not gone from American society, at least not part of the mainstream public discussion, are now really front and center. People used to call these dog whistles, but they're not even dog whistles anymore. It's just right there. You know, white supremacist groups go out and Trump says they're very fine people. Meanwhile, you have on the voting front, a lot of areas where you'll see cities, for example, in Kentucky, where they close all of the polling places and all of the drop-off boxes in the African-American parts of town. They include across the South voter ID requirements where it was very difficult to register. You could register to vote, for example, with a gun license, which is a type of identification that white voters tend to have, but not with a student ID, which is something that non-white voters tend to have. In Florida, there were a lot of efforts to keep people from voting based on various outstanding fines. Again, these fines are much more likely to be incurred and carried by people who aren't as good at working with the system or who are systematically disadvantaged by the system. So you have all these little ways to keep people away from the polls. Now, this isn't new. This has been going on for all of American history, and we've seen a lot of steps forward followed by falling back. But what we do have right now is just really explicit acknowledgement that the Republican Party is the party of white men. When you talk about the shift in suburban voters, you're really talking about a shift in the views of suburban women. White women broke for Trump in the last election. One can speculate culturally as to why that might have been, but certainly over the last 4 years, they have seen it made very, very clear that their interests economically and socially and politically are not being represented. And white women, I would hope as a white woman, are swinging back to a more inclusive way of looking at society because it's in everybody's self-interest.
So what can be done about it? And can we talk a bit about sort of the economic policy program, domestic program concerning the health situation? Because, I mean, part of the issue is that minority voters do not even have proper access to health insurance. And Trump has dismantled Obamacare and parts of it, at least.
Health insurance is a huge problem for the American economy. It's the number one thing preventing entrepreneurship, holding back job mobility, holding back just general productivity because people don't have paid sick leave. They don't have the flexibility to do what they need to do. The recent battle over the U.S. Supreme Court has shown that healthcare is really the next target for the Republican Party. They want to take healthcare away from people who have been able to claw and hang on to it. You know, one theme we have here is that the non-ruling classes in America have to work so hard just to get to square one and just to be able to make it. Black voters have to work so much harder to vote than white voters. Black voters have to work so much harder just to get to a point where they can even start to compete. And that's the sort of systemic inequity that will really hold America back in the long term if the society can't make things a little bit more fair for everybody. A Biden presidency will very much try to broaden healthcare, to push the Medicare, Medicaid expansions, to look at ways to widen the safety net. What I would expect to see from him is incrementalism and gradualism. I don't see a big move to Medicare for all or a full single-payer healthcare plan right away. Instead, I would expect to see a lot of small initiatives to expand block grants, to expand various classes of people who will find it easier to get on the federal roles, perhaps for disability or childcare or things like that. Whereas with the Trump administration, you're going to continue to see efforts to get rid of Obamacare. Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is something that even by people who mistrust it, they use it, they need it. Any move to remove it on a more wholesale basis will lead to a lot of suffering. Eventually, something better will happen, but a lot of people might die who don't need to.
Scott, any reactions to the health issue?
Yes, no, I think Rebecca painted the picture very clearly. I think it's important to remember that the United States has serious rigidities. It's really stagnating at a lot of different levels, and this is clearly one of them. The health system as a whole needs a really massive overhaul from top to bottom. What's absolutely clear in data from places like World Bank is that expenditures per capita on health in the United States are much higher than in other developed countries, much higher, and yet outcomes are worse. You've got a system that benefits some rich doctors and basically leaves a lot of people with no care at all. It's an immensely unfair system. It needs to be fixed. Unfortunately, what Rebecca said is exactly right, which is what we're more likely to see under a Biden presidency is a gradual evolutionary approach and sort of nibbling a bit at the edges, but at least protecting Obamacare. If Trump, heaven forbid, gets reelected, we'll see continued efforts to get rid of what remains of it. And there are problems with Obamacare, but a lot of them are there because Obama couldn't get through a red-blooded program to provide health care to all Americans, which is what's really needed and which is what most of the developed world has. Benefits generally, I think, need a lot of work. This is why we're seeing a lot of people out of work today with very poor prospects for getting proper unemployment insurance, unless we see a renewal of some kind of act, which hopefully we'll see. Absolutely crucial is what happens with the Senate in the next election. Currently, the Democrats have only 47 of 100 senators. For them to have a majority, they need either 51 or else 50 plus the presidency and vice presidency. At the moment, the odds are that they'll get that narrowly. I'll vote for 51. You heard me say it, but we'll see what happens. But if they don't have that, then we'll have four more years where the large initiatives remain in stagnation.
Right.
That's a great point, Scott. The Senate really continues to hold a lot of power, no matter who's in the White House.
So let's move a bit beyond domestic issues on issues that will matter hugely also for Europe. And let me first turn to you, Scott, and talk with you a bit about the agenda as regards big tech. The current administration has started antitrust proceedings against Google. There is, a huge debate also in the EU as regards the big GAFAs, the California-based tech companies. Their role as regards market dominance, but also the way they have to and should be regulated in order to ensure proper competition and ensure also a well-functioning media and information landscape. This is a huge debate on both sides of the Atlantic. Interestingly, the Trump administration has started to move on it. So how do you see that evolve also under a Biden administration?
Well, I think it's important to start by noting that there's been a huge change in this debate over the years. Historically, Europe tended to view the American-based platforms as being positive for the European economy as well. Clearly, they generate a lot of economic benefit. In recent years, there's been an increasing sense that they're exploitative, that they're anti-competitive, and also that they abuse consumer privacy. So the debate has shifted. Interestingly, in the United States, the debate has also shifted, where a few years ago, these European positions would have probably resulted in a lot of head bashing between the United States and Europe. In the United States, there's also an emerging consensus that these platforms are a problem. And it's supported both by Democrats and Republicans, but for wildly different reasons. The Democrats are worried about anti-competitive and privacy aspects. The Republicans, much more about a feeling that the platforms favor the Democrats. So for different reasons, they converge on an anti-digital platform program. Some aspects of that are already visible. Just a couple of weeks ago, the Democratic majority in the House of Representatives released a report of several hundred pages talking about competitive threats from the platforms. It's primarily about competition issues. And they focused on a wide range of potential harms. Certainly, they were concerned that several of the platforms, and they mentioned the ones that most people will talk about first, Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon. Those are explicitly listed in the report with no specific explanation about why those four, by the way, and call for a different approach to antitrust, is what they would call it in the U.S., competition law for us. They talk about restricting the ability of companies to vertically integrate, to acquire companies that operate either below or above them in the value chain, restricting their ability to enter other lines of business, possibly even breaking them up. Structural reform is there. There's some fairly extreme things there. Now, is that going to result in a war with Europe? Probably not. The language in the majority report, which I take as a strong hint of where U.S. policy is likely to go in a Biden presidency, especially if the Senate goes Democratic, the language sounds a lot like what we're hearing from the European Commission as regards a future Digital Services Act. They both speak about gatekeepers, for example. I think one of the biggest challenges on both sides of the Atlantic will be to identify who the gatekeepers are and how you identify them in a way that the courts can deal with. We've got more than 100 years of antitrust, of competition law, that answers that question for normal monopoly power. The tendency here will be to try to define new risks to competition, things like, for example, acquisitions of companies that have negligible market share today that right. could represent future competitive threats. Those are going to be the hard problems.
Rebecca, before I come to you, let me push you, Scott, on one more point, because I know that it's a point you've been working on a lot, which is the issue of data privacy, general data protection regulation, and the transfer of data across the Atlantic. This is a hugely big issue, certainly currently on the EU side. There are severe restrictions that will be imposed on the big tech companies to transfer data to the US out of basically privacy concerns. There's the Schrems case. There was a case in front of the European Court of Justice where a data advocate, Mr. Schrems, won the case. So the agreement with the US that was in place, Privacy Shield, has been nullified. So under Biden administration, will we see a new agreement between the White House and the EU trying to solve this problem and making sure that data can again be transferred across the Atlantic without any concerns?
I think this is a really key question. Under a Trump administration, I wouldn't expect much to happen, which would have very bad effect on business on both sides of the Atlantic. Under a Biden administration, I think we can at least expect a sensible discussion about it. Now, the Court of Justice of the European Union, in the decision that's often referred to as Schrems II, blocked data transfers, not because of what we usually think of as consumer privacy. The issues were that government surveillance in the United States was completely unrestricted or insufficiently restricted, and that rights of appeal, rights of redress for Europeans who had been improperly surveilled were inadequate. That was the core issue. Privacy Shield actually tried to do a bit with that, but it was a very weak institutional framework. And what the court said wasn't that it was in the wrong direction, it's that it wasn't good enough to meet European standards. So it puts a lot of pressure on both the European Union, in this case, the Commission primarily, and the US government to try to come up with a better answer. Unfortunately, we have, I would like to say, clock ticking. The court didn't provide any time lag to bring something new into place as they had with the previous Schrems decision. So at the moment, we have real possibilities of very near term disruptions in transatlantic digital commerce. So something's going to happen pretty darn quickly. I think there will be a discussion with the Biden administration, if there is a Biden administration, fingers crossed. It's a hard problem to solve. I mean, it basically means a government has to agree to restrict the surveillance that it does for national security purposes. And I don't know of any other case where that's been agreed between two governments. The fact that anything at all was agreed for Privacy Shield is a dramatic achievement.
So Rebecca, let me, if you want to comment on that point very quickly, and then I want to tap your brain on financial regulation, because I think that's another big topic. And so perhaps quickly on that point, if you have any quick reactions, Rebecca, and then...
There's a perception in Europe that a Biden administration will be a much better negotiating partner than a Trump administration has been or would be again. And that's true, but there are still going to be some pretty big gaps between how Europe and America see policy. In particular, even people who are more politically aligned, Americans have very different concepts of competition, bank regulation, what is fair than Europeans do. So they're using the same words to talk about different things. One of the things that we heard in yesterday's event, and everyone, I encourage you to go back to Bruegel and listen to the trade discussion with Cecilia Malmström, Guntram, and Adam Posen, is that there's a real tendency to see the tech debate in terms of national champions. So you have the American companies being seen as waving an American flag, and you have Europe as saying, oh no, we need to have our own people, as opposed to how can we work together? Europe is very concerned in terms of competition with keeping the landscape consistent, with preventing the erasure of players from the market, whereas America is much more concerned with innovation, with moving forward, with quality of service. And those sorts of just baseline assumptions are really going to be difficult. In the area of financial markets and banking regulation, we see that American financial stability is much more solid and established. The American system for dealing with troubled banks has been around for a lot longer. And when it went through its big test in the global financial crisis, it was shored up even more. I think we can expect to see Biden try to put back in place some of the parts of Dodd-Frank that have been rolled back under the Republican Senate and the Trump administration. I think those will tend to be incremental changes, but they will help shore up the big banks and help keep the American financial system stable. In Europe, on the other hand, people still can't agree with what's the best way to support the financial system. Do you do that with outright state aid at the national level, which is kind of the system we have right now? Do you have common deposit insurance, which improves global credibility? Do you have a situation where cross-border banking and bank mergers are encouraged? Or do you have a situation where they're discouraged because they might bring more risk into the system? Europe is still grappling with those questions. And as long as it doesn't have good answers to those, the American financial system is going to be where people can turn. Now, on the market side, I look at the stock market as a view of the future. The stock market is basically a thumbs up or thumbs down question. Do you think things tomorrow are going to be better than things today? Most people want the answer to that question to be yes. They desperately want the answer to that question to be yes. So as long as they can see a way where we get to yes, the market is going to hold steady. The market's basically priced in a Biden win. They've priced in a vaccine for the coronavirus. They've priced in incremental moves to improve a lot of this stuff. If we see a big disruption, for example, if European Facebook accounts get put in purgatory because of some sort of legal disruption or because of an outright act of regulation, then I think we could see a big market shock. Markets don't deal terribly well with surprises, even though that's their job. One last thought, and I know I'm rambling on, but I want to make sure we talk about the dollar. The dollar is the world's global currency. It still is. The euro is getting stronger. The euro is about to enter the big leagues if it can start selling bonds in a big way. But it's not there yet. European interest rates are negative. That was a policy choice made for European policy reasons. America has chosen not to go into negative interest rates, which means that in effect, American interest rates are higher. This, along with the financial stability stuff, is an incentive for global investors to continue to look toward the dollar, regardless of its relative value. Even if the dollar weakens, global investors are still looking at the dollar as the central place to put their money, just to have kind of an anchor point. The euro doesn't really know where it is. The renminbi is not a mature currency yet. The pound, goodness knows what the Brits are doing.
So Rebecca, can I push you a bit more on the dollar? Because I like that conversation, of course, a lot. It relates also to the financial system discussion that you started. And really get your thoughts a bit more on, I mean, first of all, if you can say a bit more about the Dodd-Frank Act and, you know, the extent to which the unrolling of regulation under the Trump administration will be reversed and what impact it really has. Because, I mean, stock markets loved the deregulation and reduction of taxes that Trump implemented. And so supposedly, if Biden reverses some of that, I could see the stock market also going down in some dimensions. So that's one point. And the other point where I would like to hear your reaction is really, what do you think is going to happen if we see 2 or 3 months of really contested and divisive U.S. politics over who has won the presidency? And perhaps even Trump staying, even though he did not win the popular vote because of constitutional tricks. I mean, I've seen scholars arguing that the key to the strong U.S. role as a dominant currency is the rule of law and trust that you can sort of trust the U.S. system and the U.S. Government. Now, if Trump gets reelected without being reelected, that could be a big blow to the credibility of the United States, couldn't it? So perhaps you can react to those two points.
So the stock market is a sentiment indicator more than it's a fundamentals indicator. On the one hand, the stock market likes it when things that are good for companies happen. On the other hand, the stock market likes it when the U.S. economy is doing better. So it's a little bit of a wash. I would expect Biden to go for things like bulking up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is a great societal issue, but isn't a big market issue. I would personally hope that Biden would bring back a lot of the skin in the game and ways to rein in the ability of banks to securitize risky loans without taking responsibility for the loans that they've made. I think a lot of those housing market protections have been being edged aside. I would expect to see a big debate in the US about how to handle the big banks. Should they be broken down by size or by function or not at all? I tend to belong to the school that restoring Glass-Steagall and that separating investment and commercial banking just isn't practical anymore. There's too much overlap. There's too much fungible funding. And one person's speculative proprietary trading is another person's very safe market making and liquidity provision. I would expect to hear a lot of noise on that, but I don't know that I expect to hear a lot of regulation. I do think that cross-border, we see ring fencing in all the major jurisdictions. So any sort of transatlantic financial activity, which is going to get a big boost because of Brexit. I mean, if you're in continental Europe and you need to deal with something that you need to go outside the single market for, you have a choice now of London or New York. There's no automatic benefit in going to London, or it doesn't look like there will be. So that's what we have to go there. In terms of the market reaction, the market is really suffering from crisis fatigue after the last 15 years. Canonically, the way that financial markets work, and not just stocks, but also bonds, the bond market is the driver of fundamentals and tells you whether things are really okay or not, and the derivatives market to a certain extent. Traditionally, the markets would put pressure on governments to bring back stability when a crisis loomed. The markets are so tired of showing their distress. They are so tired of pushing things to the brink. They are so tired of, particularly in Europe, governments requiring an outsized market response before putting in place some sort of solution. They just want people to get it done already. And I think that is going to inhibit some of what we would expect to see in terms of depressed markets, widening spreads, credit quality decisions that we would otherwise expect in a time of uncertainty, because the markets just want it to be okay and they're tired. And that, I think that's going to hurt the ability they're able to play in pushing the policy and pushing the politics in the right direction. My personal view.
Right. So a contested presidential election won't be visible in the financial markets?
It'll be visible, but my personal guess, and I very much hope we don't have one, and I very much would not like to be particularly right about this, but I think you would see small market movements right up into the point where it doesn't work, and then everything falls off a cliff and we have some kind of global collapse. No one wants that.
Right. Scott, do you want to add any final thought, and then we have to conclude?
Well, actually, one of the premises of your question was how likely are we to see massive political instability in the United States in the next month? And yeah. I think that's a huge question. My take is, if there's a close election at the presidential level, then indeed there's a lot of games that could be played. We'll certainly see court cases and other things anyway. If there's a blowout, if there's a landslide, then it's actually hard for the Republicans to play those games, in which case we might live in a happier world. As far as Trump staying in office, even if he hasn't won, there are constitutional games that can be played, but most of them, again, work much better if there's a close election. For him simply to refuse to go, I think, is a much less likely option. Partly, to be a successful dictator, there are things that you have to do that he hasn't done. You need support of the media. You need support of the military. He's wrecked large portions of his support with the press, and certainly, despite efforts at the beginning of his presidency to secure military support, at this point, he's turned most of them off. So I think he can't stay unless he really gets elected somehow or other.
Right. Okay. So on that cheerful note, I'm afraid our time is up. It's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you, Scott. And to all of our listeners, thank you for listening. And please do join in. And do not hesitate to also reach out to our scholars who have a lot of things to say about very, very many aspects of the US election and what it all means for the global economy. Until next time, thank you for joining, and bye-bye.